everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tales from a Vet Tech with me, Tabitha Kucera. Today, I am talking to the amazing Steven Sattell, who recently wrote some wonderful op-eds regarding AVMA's response to some of the newer legislation that is out there regarding veterinary technician and veterinary technician specialist scope of care. There are some bills in Arkansas and California. You may not be aware of these, but that's okay. We're going to break down these bills and talk a little bit more about them, why you should care as a veterinary professional, and how you can help. So enjoy, everybody. Hi, Steven. I am so stoked to have you here today.
Again.
I can never talk to Steven too much. And to be fair, listeners, you can never hear. I think he should be more everywhere, but you know, that's just me. So there have been some things happening in vet med over the last few years, especially in regards to veterinary technicians. And I think a lot of veterinary professionals, including technicians, are not aware of these things, or I'm sure they'd be as angry as we both are. So I wanted to kind of have this episode to highlight some of these things that are happening. And of course, you wrote some beautiful op-eds, which I will have in the show notes, really describing what is happening and sharing your amazing input that I also happen to agree with everything you say. So I figured to get started, can you briefly discuss what is in the content of the bills that we will be mentioning throughout the episode? I know there's the Arkansas one and the California one, and why it's scary or good.
Yeah. So I want to touch on a word that you used on the intro, angry, right? Oh. So no, that's fine. I think we are valid in our feelings. But you know, I see a lot of people that have a different perspective and like just different way at coming on at things a little bit more gently. The joke in my practices and with my friends is I always choose violence. And you know, then we have our practitioners and our colleagues that are like, well, let's educate and let's be kind and let's have a conversation. And I think angry is the right word to use in this situation, because when we're talking about what we're talking about today, which is the mid-level professional or veterinary practice associate or increased scope of practice for veterinary technician specialists, when it comes to veterinary technician specialists, we've been around for 27 years now. So if you are a veterinary professional that maybe doesn't know what a veterinary technician specialist is, or have never worked with them, you know, we've been around for 27 years. You should have at least kind of heard what we are, maybe seen what we are. So yeah, I think angry is appropriate. And for all the people that like to try to coach me, I'm a 36-year-old man now. I don't really need that. Thank you. And I think we have a right to be angry at this point, given some of the rhetoric used against us.
Right. And I think, thank you so much for pointing that out, because as everyone knows, I am very meet people where they're at. I am very kind, probably more bubbly in situations that I surprise myself that I can be. But also, as I say when I lecture, I'm all about meeting people where they're at. But there has to be a boundary and a line, and we need to hold our colleagues accountable.
Yes. Self-accountability is important.
And angry is a very good word. And these things have been going on. I have been a tech for over 10 years, which really isn't that long, but this has been an issue and it seems to be getting worse.
Yeah.
Which, as you mentioned, as people learn about what VTSs are, how veterinary technicians are amazing, you think our field would start to progress forward. But for some reason, we seem to be taking huge fucking swings backwards. So I am angry. I'm very angry. So I just wanted to touch on that. But as far as these bills, and again, I think some veterinary professionals might not even know they're being proposed or discussed too, because some of this is kind of under the radar.
Yeah. So to start out, there is a bill It's now at 161 in Arkansas. That was kind of led by a wonderful new VTS, Meg Harrington. She's a VTS in large animal internal medicine, which I think is super cool because I have mad respect, because I always have mad respect for the specialties that I know nothing about, because I know nothing about them. So I'm like, that is so cool. So she really helped spearhead some legislation in Arkansas that would increase the scope of practice for veterinary technician specialists that are in what's called a collaborative practice agreement. That collaborative practice agreement is essentially a contract with a set of rules and understandings and protocols for that VTS to essentially act as an agent for the veterinarian to establish a temporary veterinary client-patient relationship and to administer veterinary healthcare tasks. Whether that is performing a physical exam, collecting diagnostics, or dispensing medications to that animal patient in the absence of the veterinarian. And this is particularly important in the state of Arkansas because, one, they just don't have enough veterinarians and technicians and assistants to begin with, but they certainly don't have enough veterinary practitioners that are interested in large animal medicine. We're experiencing the same exact thing in California, although I would say Arkansas probably has a much larger agricultural production animal industry, comparatively speaking. So this is particularly important for that kind of sector of the veterinary industry. So this VTS in a collaborative practice agreement can establish a temporary VCPR. The veterinarian, and this is the important part, the veterinarian maintains full control of the case. The veterinarian is not abdicating any authority over the case. The veterinarian still has to make and agree with that preliminary assessment or diagnosis, if you want to get all pedantic about words. But the veterinarian maintains full authority of that case. The veterinary technician specialist can just go act without that same direct supervision as they would maybe have in a typical veterinary practice setting. The bill also allows for a veterinary technician to perform limited surgical procedures. So in that particular bill, they are not allowed to perform a surgery that enters a body cavity. So no abdominal thoracic procedures. They are not allowed to perform any surgery that is considered a neurological intervention. So no hemilaminectomies, no brain surgeries, and then no orthopedic surgeries. So it's not like they're going to be fixing bones. So really the intent there is skin biopsies, abscesses, laceration repair, maybe feeding tube placement, parapharyngeal intubation. So it does increase the allowance of that. And essentially, I have a bill that is very, very similar, a little bit different, that I'm going to be submitting next legislative session that is very, very similar to this. I think that the key differences are the surgery part, where at least the bill that's the legislation that's going to be introduced, I'm not saying that this is going to pass at this verbiage, but it would allow all the same things I just said. It would also allow for VTSs to induce anesthesia without direct or indirect supervision like we currently have in California. The Arkansas bill does something similar. And then when it comes to the surgery component, it would allow for VTSs to perform skin biopsy, specifically esophageal feeding tube placement. And for unowned animals, so these are animals like in a shelter setting, it would allow for VTSs to perform male castrates or neuters through the scrotum. So those are that's the bill. And again, similar to Arkansas, the California legislation would keep the veterinarian in ultimate authority of the case. And for both the law that's already in practice in Arkansas right now, and the hopeful California legislation, there is no prescribing, which is really, really important. We're allowed to dispense, which we do as credentialed veterinary technicians anyway. We just have a little bit more flexibility and that dispensing without the veterinarian being over our shoulder, essentially.
And in many collaborative, healthy veterinarian environments, a lot of these things, obviously, with the exception of the, well, I do, that's a whole nother thing. But a lot of these things are already happening. Mm-hmm. So there is a collaborative relationship. We're here mm-hmm. to, because yes, technicians are here to support the veterinarian, but that when I, sometimes I hear that as our only definition and it's mm-hmm. a little, it's a little insulting on a very large level because of course, but because the veterinarian is also there to support us. Mm-hmm. But I literally, now that I think of it, have literally never heard that in my entire career, which is yeah. mind-blowing now that we're kind of unpacking this.
Yeah, and I just want to mention something else. So South Carolina also has allowed for an increased scope of practice for VTSs, which was definitely under the radar. We did not see AVMA or NAVTA come out in support or against the changes in regulation in South Carolina. South Carolina's personally change is a little too broad for me. I'm a little bit concerned with how broad it is. It essentially lists what an LVT can do in the state of South Carolina. And then it says with like a two sentence little paragraph after saying a veterinary technician specialist can do things superseding this list. So it doesn't really define anything, which makes me a little bit more
understandable.
Anxious. Yes. And I could see why, you know, maybe AVMA would be against something like that. But in these more defined bills, I think the rhetoric used and the mischaracterizations of it is pretty harmful.
Yes. So as far, I know we're throwing a lot of terms. Many of you are probably familiar with veterinary technician specialists, but if not, welcome. But also, of course, many amazing, badass veterinary professionals. But as far as mid-level professional, veterinary professional associate, all these fun, lovely words, what would you say is the difference between the mid-level professional versus the veterinary professional associate? Or, well, those are similar. And then the increased scope of practice for VTS, because that can get really kind of confusing.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's getting murky. And when we talk about these things, I definitely know I'm probably confusing people because we're talking about two very similar things, but two very different things at the same time. So there is a push that is being spearheaded by a lobbying group that is well-funded by a lot of the big corporates to push for what's called a mid-level practitioner or a veterinary practice associate or veterinary professional associate. And right now, there's a group called the Vet Care Coalition out of Colorado that is pushing for this kind of master's level degree program for this thing called a mid-level practitioner or veterinary practice associate or professional associate. I can't remember what the P part stands for. But that is very different than what a veterinary technician specialist is. So from what we understand so far for these master's level degree programs, they would require a veterinary technician licensure. There was some talk and kind of is still some talk that somebody with a biology degree or an animal science degree would qualify for this program. And it's a master's degree program. And it would increase scope of practice pretty significantly compared to like a VTS. So in their scope of practice, they would allow this veterinary professional associate to do preventative care exams and diagnosis. It would allow surgery outside of the body cavity. So similar to the legislation that we see so far. And it would allow, at least in Colorado, dentistry extractions, and a few other things compared to veterinary technician specialists, which I think they were trying to increase scope of practice for as well within the same piece of legislation that was supposed to be submitted this year, but they're going to be submitting it next year. And this was kind of spawned out of a working group out of Colorado State University to develop this master's degree program. And interestingly enough, on their website, they have a video with Dr. Wayne Jensen, who is talking about the kind of draft curriculum for this master's degree program. And what I found really interesting in that video is they acknowledge the existence of a veterinary technician specialist, but he literally says in the video, this master's program makes it easier.
Ooh.
It's a package thing. And then he says it would be easier than the VTS process. So to me, I'm like, I don't understand. I don't understand why you're giving these people with a basic veterinary technology degree. I think they were talking about maybe 2 or 3 years of experience as well, entering a hybrid program like this to have more increases in scope of practice and using the word like diagnosis. And I think they were playing around with prescription also, which is going to be very difficult because they'll have to change federal law at the same time. But it's offensive to me that, you know, these programs are being developed with little input by us. I think we have some, I know we have some big names in the veterinary technology field, like Ken Yagi, that are part of these working groups. Why we don't have a better representation for veterinary technician specialists. What's also kind of interesting is I'm sure we've all heard of the Lincoln Memorial program for the master's in veterinary clinical care, or whatever that is. That is a pilot program that is kind of geared towards this end goal of creating a mid-level practitioner type program. And what's interesting about that particular program and these programs in general is AVMA has come out and said, we don't support this idea. AVMA has put that out there twice, right, in two recent articles, one in January and then one this month. That sparked all kinds of outrage. I think it's important to note that these are pilot programs. So I personally feel really bad for these technicians or individuals that are signing up for these programs, getting themselves in $20,000+ in debt for something that they're not going to have a return on investment anywhere in the near future, because right, they need to change legislation to match what this degree program is intended to do.
And hopefully that is being shared and that information is transparent, but I can see that it may not be. And when I was going through the VTS process, and this is no shade to amazing people who have obtained master's certificate things. See, my brain is broken.
Degrees.
Thank you, guys. I've only had one cup of coffee. They are amazing. I have so many amazing colleagues, but me and my colleague joked because we got our VTSs in GP, mm-hmm, which I personally think there's a lot more personally real life experiences there that benefit on a larger level. But we joke that we should have just got our master's. And I don't mean that as an insult. The reason I say that, I know Heather was on the podcast recently and we talked about how the VTS, she shared so much great advice and was very honest and vulnerable, but also the VTS isn't necessarily structured, right? Mm-hmm. So that's where it's a lot of your own. You learn on your own. If you happen to find mentors, that's awesome. I hope you do. It's so important. But there's really no structure. Versus like a college class where I go, I'm told what to do and I do it. And again, that's very important as well. But I would agree that obtaining a VTS is a lot more self-motivating. There's a lot more challenges due to that unstructured. So calling them the same thing or actually belittling VTSs which I see commonly, but I didn't watch the video, but I've read some articles. That's concerning because that's also going to discourage a lot of technicians, understandably, are discouraged from obtaining VTSs when they look into it because of stuff like this.
Yeah, I have two comments. So in speaking with people that I know that are enrolled in the Lincoln Memorial program right now, we've heard discussions, one, really talking down about VTSs and who they are and what they are. And then we have also seen this misunderstanding, and I quote from someone that had mentioned this on one of the forums, this master's program is like a VTS on steroids. When in fact, being someone that was familiar or Yeah, someone that is familiar with the curriculum, someone that got to see the curriculum before the program opened, someone that got to encourage curriculum changes for this program. I'm very well aware of the curriculum and what they're learning. It is nowhere near what a VTS is expected to know, what they're tested on. So it is not comparable, at least in my opinion. I think if we were to compare it to a veterinary technician specialty academy, I think clinical practice would be the most similar. But again, it is nowhere near the level of information that is required from a VTS or expected from a VTS. The other irony is we have a lot of VTSs teaching this master's program. And I love them, and a lot of them are really good friends of mine, but I personally do think that they are undermining the VTS credential and our goals by teaching these people that are potentially going to be superseding what we are allowed to do and the professional respect that VTSs deserve within this industry. The other thing, yeah, so the other interesting thing about the LMU program is it's all online. When the veterinary technician specialty academies are in clinical practice, at minimum, VTSs are required to have 3 years of clinical experience with 70% of their time hands-on in the clinical field. There are other academies like clinical practice and I think ZooMed that require 5 years of experience. So they're unequivocal on so many different levels. And then you had mentioned like the structure or the unstructured process of the VTS, which I do agree with at a level, but I also want to just push back a little bit because each academy does put out a blueprint of expected knowledge. Certainly the skills that you need to have signed off or not just signed
there
off.
There is not, criteria and not, guidelines. Yeah. It's not just more broad.
Basic. Yes. Not basic competency like you get with your basic RVT, CVT, LVT, LMVT credential. But you're right in that it's unstructured similarly to a residency program. And I think people need to start making this connection in their heads and maybe it'll like click for them and they'll respect us a little bit more.
I'm snapping at the air, everybody.
But this is essentially like a residency, right? Like yeah. Residency is really, really hard. So is this VTS process. And residency programs are also not particularly structured. There's no standardization within a residency program or even an internship program for that matter for veterinarians. So when we talk about the standardization and kind of the process, I think we need to kind of look at the VTS side more similarly to a residency and just have that better understanding, which kind of brings me to my second point that we see as a counter against increasing scope of practice for veterinary technician specialists, and that is the standardization of their education and training. So something that I see from the AVMA specifically, I had a conversation with the AVMA on Wednesday. It went exactly as I expected it to go. And thankfully, I had all the answers prepared ahead of time because, you know, they just need new blood and like fresh eyes and people that actually work in clinical practice and know what's going on in the world. So they're one of their big beefs or however you use that word for this conversation, is that there's no standardization in education for VTSs, which again, I say, look at the residency and internship programs, or let's look at these distributive models of veterinary schools like Arizona State University, Western Veterinary School, whatever that their official title is. Right. You have all these vet schools where they get this didactic course information, and then throughout their program, they're sent out to these clinics all around the country to get clinical experience as part of their education. And frankly, the clinics that they go to are not vetted or they're not standardized in the way they teach them how to do a spay or neuter. Yes, it's probably going to be similar to everyone else's, but they're also not teaching them a standardization on how to do their physical exam. Of course, there's so many things like this that are just non-standardized. So using this argument of standardization is just absolutely ridiculous to me, especially because medicine changes all the time. It evolves all the time, as it should. So it's almost impossible to really say that standardization is a core problem with this particular legislation.
And I think it's challenging to hear that argument, because VTSs and veterinary technicians are some of the people who have been fighting so hard for standardization mm-hmm. and utilization of us. Mm-hmm. And if this is something that you're going to throw, because again, as a VTS, that's probably more standards, you guys, that's a fun word, across the board versus, because we know in some states, you don't need to be credentialed. Mm-hmm. There's some pretty severe problems at just the foundation. And the VTS is obviously, you need to be credentialed. There are quite a few guidelines. Yeah. So if they're going to be using that as an argument, I would love for them to then start working towards helping technicians at the foundation be utilized appropriately and create a standardized education system throughout each state, which they seem to not feel isn't very important in my experience. So yeah, I find that interesting.
And what's particular cheeky, I think I see this most often with anesthesia, I think just because the circles I run in, but it is not uncommon every year when we have applicants that are denied or they don't pass the exam, the boarded specialist coming at the academies and saying, this exam is too hard. This process is too hard. They don't need to know this. They don't need to know that. So there's so many inherent problems with all of those statements. Like, one, don't tell me what we need to know and not know. Two, just because someone works for you as a boarded specialist does not automatically make them a specialist. Because when you have that mentality, you are undermining our whole process. But in the same breath, you know, we also have specialists that we work with that are absolutely supportive. And I guarantee if you ask any specialist that works with a VTS, they will say that this VTS knows way the hell more than any general practitioner in their particular specialty, knows way more than, you know, even these experienced veterinarians that are maybe in an ECC setting. You know, I experienced this when I was presenting on the drafted legislation to the California Veterinary Medical Association House of Delegates. I was expecting a fight. And I can say with confidence that at least 60% of that room was very, very supportive of the legislation that I presented. And I had the best interruptions. I hate being interrupted when I lecture, but these were the best interruptions. And they were coming from specialists and a few general practitioners who were saying, oh my God, these veterinary technicians know as much as me. They absolutely should be doing this. I think one of the GP doctors that was essentially helping me, I didn't know them before this presentation, but you know, she said, I trust the VTS a lot more than I trust myself on some of these things. So, you know, in the same breath that we have some specialists that are like, this is too hard and technicians don't need to know this, we also have a very, very supportive group. I need to throw out my business partner and CMO for the new hospital that we just opened, Remedy Veterinary Specialist, Dr. Carrie Journey. She's a veterinary neurologist. And oh my God, like she uses all of us to the line or all the allowable things that credentialed veterinary technicians are allowed to do within the state. And it's so motivating for us. And it's great to have allies like that. So I don't want to like,
Of course, we have some amazing people
our specialists too much, but
that support us, but then also sometimes on a larger spectrum, especially with some of the statements, the AVMA, not just recently, but mm-hmm. has said about technicians over the years, even though there's so many amazing supporters, some of the large orgs who are controlling what happens to us, mm-hmm. we're not. It's very easy to not feel listened to or mm-hmm. even part of the conversation in most right. There's so many organizations where as technicians, these are laws and guidelines and things for us, and no one even talked to a technician. And that just I know that that's common in the world today in lots of other aspects, but that doesn't make it okay. And it's very problematic. But again, there are a lot of amazing colleagues out there, and we love you, and please speak louder. We need that, I think, because something I was telling Stephen prior to the episode is, I know, like, legal jargon, some of this stuff can get really confusing. So many of us already feel overwhelmed with our daily workload. So I understand that everyone's not going to be as politically active in vet med as some of us. And that's why I love Stephen so much, because he can do all of it for some reason. I'm only medium in it. But I also, so I can understand why some people aren't aware of these things that are happening in the field. But also, I feel some people are aware of it, but they just don't understand how it affects them, whether they're veterinarians or veterinary technicians or veterinary assistants. So I really wanted to bring light to these topics, but also help veterinary professionals understand why you should care about these things and maybe get a little more invested. And if you are a veterinary specialist or a board certified veterinarian, why you maybe, hey, can you pop into a Zoom, or can you stop at that meeting and find out about it? Because that's a whole nother thing. Sometimes these meetings are surprises, and that's done on purpose, everybody.
And, you know, when you were, I want to bring up one more argument that I keep hearing against increased scope of practice for veterinary technician specialists. And that is a newer one, a very weak one, because when I was having my conversation with AVMA, they kept pivoting because they couldn't answer the question, because there is no really good answer. And frankly, I think part of this falls on them, and their concern with increased scope of practice is that all of the academies, I believe, except for one, as long as you're a credentialed veterinary technician and you're legally allowed to practice in wherever you're living, you can apply for the VTS process. And we all know that there are grandfathering, alternate routes, these kind of loopholes to become credentialed. And their concern is they have these professionals getting a VTS, that they don't have this AVMA accredited program behind them. But I kept reminding them that the VTNE, and even before the VTNE, like the California licensing exam, these are minimum competency exams. So if you can pass it, you can pass it, similar to the bar. Like, there are alternate route paths to become a licensed attorney within various states. That doesn't mean that these professionals are going to be any less educated or skilled compared to these AVMA accredited programs. Yes, the end goal is ultimately for everyone to have gone through a program, because I think that is a standard that should be met. But the reality is, and we have hard peer-reviewed data on this from 2013, the Norcus et al. Study, showing that most VTS applicants now have been in the field for 11 to 15 years. So these are not, I don't love the term baby techs, but these are not new credentialed veterinary technicians applying for these things. These are very experienced people applying for these VTSs. And then the other thing that I think we kind of need to think about the grandfathering, and I used my name, is a lot of the leaders out in the world, especially the veterinary technician world, whether that is myself, I became credentialed before completing. I'm still enrolled in an AVMA accredited program. I did not go through an AVMA accredited veterinary technician program. But Harold Davis, Ken Yagi, David Liss, all these, Kara Burns, all these big names within the profession that are our leaders, that are writing books, that are helping with legislation, all these big things that you go to their CE, did not go through an AVMA accredited program before they got credentialed. So, you know, are we really going to say, yeah, Harold Davis, yeah, Stephen, yeah, Ken Yagi, you don't deserve to have your VTS? No.
They're pulling at, I mean, they're really trying
It's a weak, 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 weak argument. Yes. And frankly, the AVMA should have done a better job in these states that are allowing for these loopholes to still exist. So don't come at me with a problem that you never
That's what it seems like it's. And the thing is, the problems, these problems that they have not addressed at all, actively, actually negatively addressed, like not only not addressing it, but when it's tried to be addressed by other orgs where they don't even have to do anything, they fight against it.
Yeah. And this example is a little bit, I hope no one's too sensitive, but you know, we have a lot of foreign trained veterinarians where the veterinary education curriculum is very, very different, especially if they're not an AVMA accredited program. We have a lot of countries, their veterinary education curriculum is really focused on large animal only. And it is, I know this for a fact because what I'm just a nerd and I've already researched it, but two, like I have these conversations with these people all around the world all the time. And I'm like, you're doing what? Why? What? You don't know anything about this. And they admit I had no small animal training whatsoever.
Yes.
But when these people that did not go through an AVMA accredited program apply and do all the assessments that they're supposed to do to sit for the NAVLE, why is that not considered the same kind of thing with what we're trying to accomplish here with the VTSs, except those people that never had small animal surgery training are allowed to legally, you know, ethically, whether they do it or not is a different question, but they're allowed to legally do a brain surgery the next day if they wanted to, despite maybe never working on a cat or a dog or performing that particular surgery. Whereas the VTS process, you need to have mastered these things. So I just want to throw that out there because there's just so much like, you haven't done this, or what about this? What about that? There are so many whatabouts on the other side as well that I think need better attention.
And that's why I love you for multiple reasons, but also you're more than open, which I think is a good educator, a good technician. We are more than open to, if you have a concern or a question, let's unpack that. Let's let's discuss that. We're not deflecting. We're not creating fake narratives. Like, let's have this discussion. We want to collaborate. We want the field to be better for all of us. And that's the other thing. Sometimes I love all my veterinary colleagues. And sometimes I feel like the larger orgs are trying to do this us against them vibe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all don't understand it, but someone has to understand it because it's so prevalent. And the better we are, the better they are. We're all, it's just mind blowing that it's such a narrative.
Like I said, I choose violence, right? So like, you know, there are people that are really good at being more political than I am as far as like gentle wording and like, let's work together and have more discussions for another 3 years and not accomplish anything. I'm not that guy. Like, I respect those people. They're needed, but that's not me. That will never be me. So there's that. And then I have like another example I wanted to throw out there as far as increasing scope of practice for veterinary technician specialists and how well that could work. I guess I have two. So one is when you are looking to use even just your credentialed veterinary technician to the limits of the law, in whatever state you live in, we have a paper coming out on this later this year. We had some old figures where a credentialed technician being used to the highest level of their licensure could easily bring in $90,000 a year in additional revenue to that practice. That number has now changed to well over $160,000 a year when a technician is used to their fullest abilities of their license. When you add on these collaborative practice agreements or increasing the scope of practice for veterinary technicians, I think that number is probably going to double easily for these practices, as well as increasing access to care. And, you know, there's this new term being thrown out there called the spectrum of care, right? Like veterinary professionals, I'm evolving on this because I'm still very much a gold standard kind of guy. But there is an important discussion that needs to be had about always trying to provide the gold standard, which can't always be met financially or even practically by some pet owners. So offering a spectrum of care is going to be important. And I think veterinary technician specialists definitely fall in that. You know, I would not expect if a cat came in with an ear infection, that they're going to pay exactly the same amount as they would for a veterinarian, which I think would be able to help a lot more animals. And then certainly, like I said, in California, we don't have enough veterinarians to treat large animals. We certainly don't have enough veterinarians to treat shelter animals. In fact, Assemblymember Calra here in California put out a resolution essentially begging other veterinary professionals to come to California and work in the large animal and shelter setting. So this is, again, where VTSs could go into that shelter setting or work in that large animal setting to provide care that is desperately needed. Now, a model that I think we need to pay attention to that has been around since 1966, since the Animal Welfare Act was first written and put into law, is the biomedical research lab animal field. So per the Animal Welfare Act, non-veterinary professionals are allowed to perform surgery and provide veterinary care to animals within a research facility as long as they have documented and maintained training records on how to do these particular procedures, or there are protocols to follow. So a great example of this is when I worked at UC Davis at the California National Primate Research Center, all the technicians were used like doctors. We had protocolized medicine. If a monkey has diarrhea, do these diagnostics, provide this level of treatment, dispense this medication. You know, this same kind of model can be used within general practice, I think, safely. We see this in human medicine. And what's nice about the lab animal community is we have successful documentation of how successful this model is going back to 1966, because it's all public record. You can FOIA it, Freedom of Information Act. You can get all of these records showing that there is success, that the world is not falling apart because a non-veterinarian is performing a non-invasive or even a very invasive procedure. You know, myself, I worked in a cardiac cath lab and I was placing stents in the coronaries. I was placing stents in the brain. Like, I can guarantee you most veterinarians out there do not know how to do that. Did these animals in my care, these hundreds of animals where I was doing these procedures or performing cardiac surgery on these animals, die or like have these terrible consequences? Absolutely not. So I think, you know, with appropriate protocols, training and maintaining of those records, we really need to look at the lab animal community as kind of this precedent that's been around for decades on end and how successful this could be.
And I do think along with all those other more access to care, more affordable care, even though I'm that gold standard girl as well. But also I work in animal welfare and low cost medicine shouldn't be shit medicine. Check mm-hmm. that episode out. But mm-hmm. I can critically think and practically apply things in multiple different situations because of my experience. But also you're empowering, which everyone talking about where are technicians going, guys, we haven't gone anywhere. The problems have been around for a long time. We've just ignored them. And then we create this narrative over the pandemic that all of a sudden there's none of us. But we are also then empowering technicians, helping them grow. And for example, in animal welfare, so many amazing animal welfare professionals who have no veterinary background are thrown in. Shout out to all of you, because I've worked with many of you to the point now where I was like, I have to create videos of how to draw blood. Like, these are things I didn't. Because of my, I just didn't think about it. And then I go into these shelters and these amazing animal professionals are go draw blood. They aren't taught how to hold a syringe. They aren't taught how to hold a needle. They are just thrown into these situations. And then the staff member that is teaching them was taught that way. So they weren't really taught. And then it's this mm-hmm. vicious circle. So not only will this help more people get access to care in animal welfare, but also it can help get animal welfare in shelters experienced veterinary professionals, and they're more likely to have some standardization of care. I mean, I could just go, because we all know certain things are happening mm-hmm. anyways. Mm-hmm. So if we can just, not that that's the reason why, but let's help support these people. Let's give them resources. And we've, as you discussed, we've created some wonderful ways, including some of this legislation, to address these issues. So I really hope, I mean, it's an exciting time. I do focus on the positive, Stephen. I am angry as hell, but I also, because I always joke with people, they're like, how are you so positive? I'm like, if I was the other way, you guys, I'd be suicidal all the time. Real talk. So I'm not like toxic positivity. It's just,
yeah.
There are so many amazing, like the fact that technicians like you and all these other amazing technicians that fucking inspire me every single day to be better and to fight, because we've all felt very alone. There's really cool things happening, but I would love for more of you lovely people out there to recognize that these things are happening and that you do matter, your voice matters, and that you can make a change. So with that beautiful segue, how, because all of you want to help now, how can veterinarians, veterinary assistants, veterinary technicians, VTSs, how can they help? And I know that's a very broad question, but...
Yeah, so I think it's really important for veterinary professionals to be involved in their local VMAs, right? So similar to what we see with national politics, yes, federal laws are really important. They can be really scary, but also a lot of things happen at the local level. So being involved in your VMA, whether you like them or not, is going to be important because as a constituent, essentially, they use your name and your number as a member in their lobbying efforts. You being a constituent or a member of that local veterinary medical association or technician association and voicing your ideas, your opposition, your approval is so important. It doesn't mean you necessarily need to go to lobby days and go lobby with your association or write articles, but let your voice be heard and demand that your voice be heard. They are taking your money every year. Yes, they have member benefits. I think most of us don't use a lot of those member benefits, but make sure your voice is heard. And then also there's a huge aspect of personal accountability here. You know, people are like, oh, you're really hard on AVMA, you're really hard on NAVTA. And I used to say, yeah, like I am hard on them. But then somebody else that's very well involved with them was like, you're not hard on them. You're just making sure they're accountable. So hold your professional associations, your colleagues accountable. Ask them the whys. Ask them what makes them scared about particular initiatives that they don't seem to support that maybe you support. And make sure you read those newsletters, because those newsletters actually are filled with a lot of information about what that organization is trying to do. And then if you're super, super duper nerdy and want to get super engaged, if you go to your state's legislature page, you can sign up for emails that will ping you when certain legislation is involved with like keywords. So like in our California legislature, I have emails that come to me if the word animal or veterinary is used in a draft bill. So you can see what's happening in your state.
That is genius. I'm doing that today.
Yeah. And whether you need to speak up or, you know, be supportive. And then also writing your legislatures and saying, yeah, I support this, or no, I don't support this. And I have a perfect example of that. It pissed off a lot of the holistic veterinarians in my state, but you know, I don't really care. So there was a bill in California that would allow veterinarians to discuss and recommend cannabis products. Obviously, I'm very supportive of that. What I did not support in the bill is they called cannabis a medicine. Mm. And, you know, because I'm a little bit pedantic sometimes, medicine is not an appropriate word for cannabis. It is certainly a supplement. So I had them, I reached out to my assembly member who actually authored the bill. And I was like, hey, you know, technically medicine is not an appropriate word here. And it might actually be violating state and federal laws. So we changed cannabis medicine to cannabinoid product that may have therapeutic effect. Like that doesn't seem like a big change, but it is a big change because when we introduce vernacular like that, we're not going to go on that soapbox today, but like veterinary nurse, right? It can take
language
off.
Matters a lot. Yeah,
language matters,
especially and it can, in legislation.
Yeah. So, you know, little things like that, that's an example of how someone can get involved. And since then, you know, we've had great conversations with that assembly member and have got to put input into other pieces of legislation. So, you know, words matter and getting involved and being having some accountability as a professional within this industry and trying is going to be really important because when things happen and we're not aware of it, going to social media or being angry about it when it's too late isn't helpful.
No, I understand being angry, but I'm also get shit done kind of person. So I'm upset about whatever it may be. There's multiple situations. And then literally my brain goes to what do I have in my power? Because you have different skill sets than I do. We have different learning histories and life experiences. But especially thankfully in vet med, I have a lot of experience. So I feel very confident. And that's the other thing. It's going to be the general public is so unaware of all these things. And even some animal professionals as a whole, behavior, welfare, it is like different worlds and they have no idea the things that I've mentioned to my colleagues working in behavior who don't work in the vet med world and how we've had these beautiful discussions and they're amazing, but they literally had no idea about some of these things. So as experts and people in this field, I do feel like you have a little bit of a responsibility.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I'm a very like... Be the person you want to see in the world, make the changes you want to see in the world, and don't just bitch, do something.
And you know, what's important about that is regardless of the veterinary technician scope of practice stuff, or even the discussion about mid-level practitioners, throughout the country, we have other human healthcare professionals creeping in to veterinary medicine and being allowed to do various things, which personally, I don't agree with. You know, we have physical therapists that go through a 5 or 6 week course and they're allowed to perform physical therapy on animals without necessarily the supervision or guidance of a veterinarian. Yes, a veterinarian in many states is supposed to be referring them to a physical therapist, but oftentimes that veterinarian that's referring them doesn't know what's good or bad when it comes to physical therapy. They're relying on the expertise of the physical therapist. Exactly. Or chiropractors or even dentistry now with dental hygienists doing these little pop-up clinics of doing anesthesia-free cleanings, right?
Thankfully, that's not as common in Ohio, but California, that's so funny. So I was visiting, I was lecturing in near UC Davis. And I was just taking a walk with my friend who lives there, and I saw a van, like a mobile grooming van vibe, and it said anesthesia-free dentistry. And I immediately went over threshold, and I said, "What the fuck?" And I asked her to elaborate, and then she continued to tell me. And I was so over threshold that I was not in a way to communicate effectively in that moment because I understand how communication works. But then I did research, and again, guys, I knew that that is told and groomers call it, but it's just brushing the animal's teeth once, which is how I'm trying to help the general public and groomers understand that they're using the wrong language. But legit, they were taking tartar off. Jesus.
You know, the other kind of creep that we see within veterinary medicine that, again, it's like, if these people get to do this, why the hell are VTSs? And even in most cases, why aren't credentialed veterinary technicians allowed to do this? Is acupuncture. We have this terrible, terrible, terrible misunderstanding within this country, with the exception of a few states, that only a veterinarian can perform acupuncture. That is not true in most states. A veterinarian can assign for a technician to perform acupuncture, or even a veterinary assistant. It is not uncommon, especially here in California, for these doctorates in acupuncture, whatever, these human-focused people performing acupuncture in the role of a veterinary assistant within practices. Yet, many of these acupuncture courses, whether it's through Qi University or UC Davis's program, which is basically connected with Qi, or some of these other programs out there, they gatekeep and will only teach acupuncture to veterinarians, even though it's legal for veterinary technicians and assistants to perform it under the supervision of a veterinarian, which is super frustrating. So anyway, I just want to throw that out there.
No, there's a lot to unpack. And for example, the rehab thing, dog anatomy, cat anatomy, completely separate things, let alone human anatomy. I personally would never, I don't know anything about human bones. I probably should, but I'm also aware of what I know. So the fact that, and also to all the amazing physical rehab technicians, specialists, board certified veterinary rehab, I can't imagine how infuriating. And guys, that's dangerous as fuck. I mean, the amount of danger. So another thing you can do as a veterinary professional, I talk about it with when you're referring out to behavior professionals all the time, because it's very important to do your research because it could literally be life or death, physically and emotionally for these animals and their caregivers. But when it comes to referring to a rehab specialist, like, don't just look at their website. It might only, literally, it might only take 5 minutes, really. And if someone gets, if you call and they get upset when you ask about credentials, that's obviously a huge, especially in a field of medicine, that is a huge red flag. I don't care. Because even in my, like, locally, I'll see someone calling themselves a heart, like a cardiologist. They like hearts and they're a veterinarian.
Yeah, special interests.
I'm just, and have. Again, and I'm not saying, like, but there is a concern there. And, you know, I, like, hypothetically, let's say that a general public caregiver reaches out to that person and they spend thousands of dollars and it, the issue, the problem gets diagnosed miscorrectly due to the lack of resources and or education. And then they go to a cardiologist. Again, you could definitely have a special interest. And I love that. I work with so many amazing veterinarians who have special interests in behavior and they're amazing. And I refer to them all the time, but just like, I don't call myself a behaviorist because that's reserved for veterinary behaviorists and CABs. But when I see someone calling themselves a behaviorist and they aren't, immediately my head is like, huh? Question mark? Maybe they just don't know, because a lot of people just don't know better. But I'm already critically thinking and being like, I need to ask more questions. So just, I think that that's just a general fun rule for all of us. And that way we're advocating for our field and our patients, for that matter, and our caregivers. Because
know who you're actually referring to.
Please. It sounds so cliche, but I know, I joke, I say sadly that, you know, 10 years ago, it still makes me sick to my stomach. I was just Googling trainers and it makes me so nauseous and disgusted with myself.
Trainers, air quotes.
Air quote, right? Because that's a whole, again, and getting people, and there's even behavior professionals out there who are like, like I've heard this about vet techs too, which it's data to me, Stephen, where I hear people say, no one cares about credentials. I'm like, fucking data. That's fucked that they don't. And we need to help them understand. Like, we don't take that in and say, why fucking bother learning? Because they don't fucking care, which is what I hear more often than you would think. We should be changing that narrative and using that data to be like, oh, we should help them understand, because they want the best for their animals. And you do have a responsibility to your patients. But anyways, my soapbox right there. So I know we could talk about so many more things, but Stephen took time out of his important day at his lovely new, I have to come visit your hospital. That's so exciting.
I would just like to say that where I'm at right now is not my new hospital. This is still at Stanford. I'm in a basement office because I needed somewhere quiet. So this is not a reflection of anything. I am literally in a basement right now. So yeah,
When your new hospital is has opened already, though, right?
It is. We technically opened July 18th.
Amazing.
But I'm going to be finally doing an announcement. We wanted to, like,
you know, sorry.
No, it's fine.
Oh, okay.
We have it's literally going to be in 3 days when I make the announcement. Okay. So we just had little tweaks and stuff like that I wanted to do before I post pictures and, you know, share the website and all that stuff. So, I'm super, super excited.
That is such an amazing resource to everybody there. Oh, that's so exciting. And I'll probably have you back on to talk all about that, because I think that could be another wonderful episode. But I always like to end with, what is something that currently makes you happy? It could be your amazing new hospital or an amazing cup of coffee you had this morning. But what is something that currently brings you joy, Stephen?
Something that currently brings me joy. So I've been in a lot of different sectors in veterinary medicine. A lot of it has been lab animal. And I love the animals that I work with so, so much and give them the best care possible. But it feels so different and fantastic to see, like, clients again and, like, really client-owned animals and building that relationship with not only that animal, but also the clients, you know. Just this past week, we had clients I was helping them with doing some CBD consults, and the owner's crying in the room, and I get these fantastic emails back saying, oh my God, this has helped. All these other medications didn't work. So getting to be on the client facing side again feels really, really good, you know, and it makes me feel rejuvenated in my career. So I'm really happy that I'm getting back involved in the more clinical aspect side. Because normally, like I said, I'm in the lab animal setting, or I go into a practice as a consultant and I'm like helping them with anesthesia or pain stuff, but it's not really my patient, or I'm not developing that same type of relationship. So getting to develop those relationships with clients and animals again is great.
Love it. As you know, I'm so thankful to have you as a colleague, as a friend in this field. I know you get a lot of shit. I appreciate every fucking thing you do. Please keep being you. And seriously, you inspire the fuck out of me. So just thank you so much for taking the time.
Same to you.
Thank you so much for taking the time. And I'm sure I'll talk to you soon.
I'll chat with you later, Tamitha.
What a wonderful interview with Stephen, and so helpful to kind of break down the content of those bills, because I can understand that some of that can get murky and confusing with all the information out there, which is partially why I wanted to record this episode with Stephen, who is an expert and recently wrote some amazing op-eds on the content and AVMA's response, which I'll share in the show notes. But I hope everyone enjoyed the episode and do their part to help elevate our veterinary field forward. Have a wonderful day, everybody.